The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Really excited to have Scott Anderson, who is... If you're familiar with John Piper's Desiring God, you'll be familiar with the work that Scott's doing there as CEO, and obviously important in the life of that ministry. You'll hear more about the transition with John Piper and what's ahead of that. Charlie Dower is at the Oaks, who stepped in several years ago for Bruce Williams, who many of you know, and of course Ben Merkel is now the official second president of New St. Andrews, and so we'll hear more about that. So let me ask if we could just bow our heads. We'll begin our time with a word of prayer. And we'll jump in. Father, as we gather for this next discussion, we're thankful that you are a God who is unchanging throughout the ages, that we don't need to fear that you're going to be replaced or usurped by another God or another transition. And yet, for us here in this transient world, we recognize that leadership changes happen, that organizations evolve. And Lord, it is our deepest desire that we are faithful to the calling you've placed on us as classical educators and with respect to the individual institutions that we represent. So I just pray that our time would be fruitful and inspiring and that you would give us wisdom and ideas that we can take back and to put into place. We thank you for this time of learning and engagement. And we pray in Jesus' name, amen. All right. Well, Scott, you want to start us out?
Well, good afternoon. It's great to be with you all. And I will acknowledge right at the outset I'm the obvious black sheep on the panel in that I'm not coming from your world of Christian education, and so I just grant that my vocational calling is a little different than many of yours. Those of you that are Christian educators or administrators or board members, you have your domain expertise over here, and I'm in more of the tech space and the content delivery, the messaging world over here. But I do. I would argue that we share a common headwaters, so to speak, and that is, I think we are in the faith-based nonprofit sector, and we care deeply about communicating truth to other people. You all, primarily to the next generation, and Desiring God to anybody that will come to the website or who will read our books. But I do think that maybe is the reason why Davies and David asked me to be on this panel, is there are some similarities sort of upstream in terms of what we're trying to do from a mission standpoint, a strategy standpoint, and from this issue of the theme for today, good growth and healthy organizations, and specifically transition, which is the focus of this panel. So I thought, just to set the table for you, I'd give you a little bit of my context at Desiring God. So if you're unfamiliar with our ministry or John Piper in particular, you'll maybe know why I'm up here answering questions today. So the brief history is simply this. Dr. John Piper was the pastor of Bethlehem Baptist Church from 1980 until 2013. He preached his last sermon as the pastor there on Easter Sunday. But the seeds of Desiring God were really planted back in 1987 when a book published by Multnomah was released in February of that year, and it was entitled Desiring God, The Meditations of a Christian Hedonist. And at that time, Pastor John was pastoring an old, somewhat dying inner city church just on the edge of I-94 in downtown Minneapolis. He lived 7 minutes away in the poorest neighborhood, the most racially diverse neighborhood of the Twin Cities, and he's still living there to this day. That was the context. It was a little church with a little church pastor who wrote a book with some big truth in it. There was no sense of what might come of that. There was no conception of over 50 books, and 23 years later, a web ministry that is reaching hundreds of millions all over the world. And so we're humbled by that history, but remember, in 1987, it was just a book. and it was just a book written by a little church pastor. But early on, they determined that Pastor John determined, along with the elders of Bethlehem Baptist, that he would not take any royalties from his writings. He guessed that there might be other books to be written, and that his personal sort of understanding of money and some of the dangers of it, the desire to move toward need and away from comfort, the desire to cap your standard of living and live on less than you make, that type of mindset really infused his teaching there at Bethlehem, and so he determined from the outset, I'm not going to take a dime of royalty money from these books. So they created the Christian Hedonism Expansion Fund, the Chef Fund, and they put a guy who was serving as Pastor John's assistant at the time in charge of that. So any royalties that came in could be distributed through the Chef Fund. And that was neat. There was a little bit of revenue that came in, and they got to go and sort of seed other Christian enterprise and help other people understand and embrace the truths of Christian hedonism. Well, 7 years later, another major thing happened at Bethlehem Baptist Church. This was 1994. The elderly couple that was running the cassette tape ministry decided to stop doing that. So big deal. The church is now about 1,000 people, and I don't remember their names. It was an older Swedish combination, the Sven and Oli, or something like that. There was this dear couple that was stopping running the cassette tape ministry. So what are we going to do? Well, Pastor John came and asked his assistant if he'd take it over, you know, make it work, continue the tape ministry. And so this guy who was in charge of John's schedule was in charge of the Chef Fund and was in charge of now the tape ministry. And there you have it. Pastor John, right, funding to take Christian hedonism, the truth of it to the world, and media come together. And in 1994, they decided to call it Desiring God Ministries. And that's how it all began. Ultimately, it was Pastor John's assistant running the tape ministry, distributing some funds on the side. And that was 1994, and here we are today, and with God's help and blessing, we're doing what we're doing. I came there, just to set you up contextually, personally, I came in 2001, came on staff at the ministry. I was overseeing their children's curriculum for a while, and then overseeing the marketing, and then took their events. That was about an 8-year stint of just taking one event, growing it to 4, doing annual national conferences and regional conferences. And then I worked in networking and partnerships where we sought to find win-win opportunities where our resources could run on the good rails of other ministries and be a blessing for their constituents, but also get our truth out to places that we weren't equipped to go. And then in 2010-ish, then there were some talks and some changes, and I took over as president and CEO. We've had a lot of iterations as a ministry. So we've done a lot of things through the years, from cassette tape duplication and CDs to quasi-book production. We had a children's curriculum that we launched. We had a UK office for about 5 years trying to do what we did in Minneapolis over in the UK. That didn't work real well. It's no longer around. We ran 2 brick-and-mortar bookstores. We ran an online bookstore, we had a film studio, a national radio broadcast, a volunteer ministry, prison ministry, international outreach ministry, and this thing called a website. A lot of iterations through the years, that's a different story, but suffice for now that the Lord has brought us through different seasons of ministry and opportunity and transition, and now we're on the threshold of what is a really interesting one. Pastor John is now 71 years old. He's not been pastoring for a few years. He's been working full-time at Desiring God. It is a weird thing to be the guy that signs John Piper's paycheck. It's a very strange thing. And also to be entrusted now with the leadership of this organization that has such an amazing history and amazing outreach. So we're at that point of transition. John's a finisher. He's not going to retire anytime soon, and he's going to keep doing what he does for as long as God gives him. We don't know how long that is. And so as a board and a leadership team, we're in the process of trying to figure out what it looks like to carry forward that legacy into the finishing years and then beyond into the post-Piper years, such that we could have another 75 or 100 wonderful years of ministry. So that just sets the table for me, why I'm here in the context of desiring God, and I'll kick it over to Charlie here.
That's exciting. I love to hear that vision for Desiring God Ministries. My story is very different from that. I am kindergarten through 12th grade, head of school, and the school that I work at is called The Oaks. It's in the Spokane Valley, and that school, we're now in our, just completed our 21st year on Friday. School ended for us just less than a week ago, so we crash landed into the conference. This is kind of our rest time now, but we're thankful to be here. 21 years ago, the Oaks was founded, probably like your school was, parents coming together around a dinner table. Out of that came a headmaster who ran the school for 18 years, and he's actually here with us, and he loves attention. He loves being singled out, so Bruce, would you please stand? If you don't know Bruce Williams, you need to. He is a wonderful man. He ran the school for 18 years. 4 years before he headed out, he had been in conversation with the board, and I had been one of several names mentioned to pick up the mantle and move forward with the school should he move on at some point. For 4 years, I had a gift that very few people ever get to have, and that is mentorship. Focused, just poured into me. It resulted in me being fired in writing 3 times. I was actually one time picked up and put against the wall. It was one of those types of mentorship relationships, and now I have the microphone. But it was a beautiful thing. Bruce groomed me. I started as a part-time teacher, became a full-time teacher, moved into administration, then into... I was an assistant to Bruce. I was a 7th through 12th grade principal, and then from that point moved on in as the headmaster of the school. And the thing that I so appreciated is that whole time, that whole transition, Bruce poured personally into me, and it was for the sake of the community. And it was a huge gift that's impacted my family. It was a huge gift to us as a school community as well. So that was 3 years ago now. And Bruce is now in Texas. He's started a school and is growing it up there. The Oaks is, again, I said K-12. We're about 320, next year probably about 340 students, kindergarten through 12th grade. And the biggest blessing in our transition, I think, was watching the way in which Bruce set the table for me personally and for the community. And that is something that I have had limited opportunities to see other places, but just enough to know that it's rare. And it's rare to have someone delight to give something away in a blessing to the community. So that's why I'm here. Dr. Merkel.
Well, good afternoon. My name's Ben Merkel. I'm president of New St. Andrews College. NSA started in the fall of 94, and if you do a little bit of math, then you would see that a student who was in the first class at Logos School, the kindergarten class, when it started in 1980, would have just graduated from Logos that spring, and the fall of 94 would be the freshman class for that student. I won't make her stand like Bruce had to. Anyhow, so my wife was in that first class. Logos goes all the way through, and New St. Andrews starts in 94. I was a University of Idaho student across the street. Wondering who those weird people were. I was studying to be a chemistry teacher at the University of Idaho, but I heard about NSA and I heard that they offered Greek, and I really wanted to take Greek, and so I did take Greek that first year. So I guess I'm kind of in that first little class at NSA, though I was actually a U of I student. Met my wife in that Greek class. We got married. Started as a minister at Christ Church doing campus evangelism to U of I students, but then got pulled into the NSA world and started initially basically as adjunct faculty. And then that slowly took over my life till I was full-time there. So I was full-time faculty at NSA and then moved my way into administration. Now, NSA started in 94 in the dining room of Dr. Roy Atwood's house. And Roy was the first president of New St. Andrews, and so he was my boss all of those years. And I kind of learned about the world of college from him. I moved into administration. We took a little hiatus as I did my doctorate and then came back and ended up as the dean at the college. Roy stepped out at the, I believe it was the end of 94. It was like Thanksgiving of 94. Because I was dean, I ended up as an interim president. And then after the whole search process, I ended up being named as the full president. So I've just completed 2 years as college president. And I'm sure many of you are, if you're here, you're probably administrators of one stripe or another. And I just find it constantly strange as I look at my job as college president and seeing how in order to get to be the head of a school, you generally had to have spent a lot of time as an academic of some stripe. I was training as an academic. I did my doctorate in Oriental Studies. And so everything was academic. And then suddenly, at the end of this academic career, you find yourself dropped into a management position, and it's the management position at the top of a large organization. And you find yourself dropped into a job that you have, feels like, zero training for. However, I've been really blessed with an extremely supportive board and a fantastic faculty. It's really great having a group of men who were all my colleagues and friends for a number of years and who continue to be really supportive of me bumbling through this office now. But it is exciting. It's definitely intense to walk through a transition like this. I've been really blessed, as I said, by having a really supportive board. And also, I think, just a natural affinity for the work that we're doing. I love what NSA is doing. I love the work that you all are doing because we get a lot of your students, and it has already been remarked from up here a few times how students that come from a classical Christian school just stand out. And those are all the kids that we get, and it's remarkable what we're able to do with graduates from your schools. We're really grateful for your labors and interested to hear your questions.
Thanks so much, Ben. You know, thinking about the topic of passing the baton from founders, I think really the transitions we're going to be looking at are relevant in all aspects of the life of the school. Clearly, a founder of a school transitioning to the next, to the head, that's at the top, that's the big transition. But think about how often schools are disrupted, even if it's in a grade level. The third grade teacher that's been there for 20 years and the new teacher comes in, or the middle school principal or dean steps in, or high school. All of these little changes, the institutional knowledge shifts and maybe is lost and goes, in many cases, maybe goes in a very good direction. But I'm just, kind of my first question to you guys, thinking about how fragile it can be in organizations. And a reference point I have from Atlanta, kind of the Chick-fil-A world, when Truett Cathy started his little sandwich business. We keep talking about Chick-fil-A today. I get hungry every time we talk about this. But it was a big deal for that organization when a founder created and brought from literally the first chicken stand all the way up to this billion-dollar company. How do you make a transition and not cause the company to implode? They brought in Jim Collins, who had written Good to Great. It was a big deal because the fragile nature of that, especially when that founder's still alive. And I know a lot of churches have struggled with that, where the pastor that was there for 30 years transitions, the new guy comes in, but the pastor sits on the front row every Sunday, and it creates all kinds of tension. So I guess my first question for each of you, being in very different arenas, what's maybe one thing of many, I'm sure, that was the most helpful to you as you stepped into that position that maybe was given to you by the founder, or a vision or something you were working off of that really helped anchor you? Was there a gift or a instruction or direction? What was most helpful to you following a founder?
Well, I'm trying to think of a way to answer that in a way that would be helpful to this audience. Maybe I'll just start by naming the difference. John Piper never ran Desiring God. And so, in that sense, you had a founder who was involved in the organization in integral ways, essential ways, and yet didn't want to run it. And so you had this, you have this dynamic where there's influence exerted on the staff and on the organization, its culture and its ethos, and yet it's coming from the seat of authority of a founder who's not actually the one leading the organization. And so I think that's a strength in a sense, because it allows him to care about the color of the carpet, but he doesn't make that decision, so to speak. But his decisions considered really, like his preferences are considered really well, or at a high level. So I say all that to say, I don't know that maybe Christian schools are, that's the issue, unless you have a founding headmaster, or you have a dynamic with your board, maybe, where there's a particular board member or a high net worth donor that has exerted that type of out of the seat of authority control. So they don't really have a place in the organization, but they have significant influence. Maybe that exists, but that's been for me, there's a dance to that. There's a learning of that. But I'm getting around to the fact that's a huge blessing. I've had 16 years to work with John in a non-work capacity. Like he's not my boss in that sense. The board ultimately is who I report to. And so there's a huge trust quotient that builds up over time. So I think for me, the big strength in this transition having gone well is there were years for me to learn him and the board and grow in my own leadership ability, and there were years for him to watch me, observe me, kind of poke on my rough edges, confront me at times, things like I did not get thrown up against a wall, but there's those types of conversations that need to happen. As young leaders, we need to come up under the wisdom of years, and frankly, it's an honoring thing to listen to the sort of preferential sort of biases that the founders have. So I see it as, it can be a little weird maybe, but it's also a huge strength that there's just been years in the saddle together, and that has made this transition go really, really well.
I think possibly the greatest gift that was given to me was the use of the unique platform that the founder has in terms of the relationships across the entire organization with the broader constituency, with the staff, and using those relationships, those connections, the trust that's been built up through all of those years, all the battles fought and won, and using that to, over a period of time, communicate through time spent with me, trust and belief that this is the right person, but then also doing that vocally, taking opportunities that you may not see coming in a staff meeting, to say, and in a couple of years, Charlie will, so on, take on and he'll lead or what have you. Doing that with parents around and communicating gradually that this is the person that you should start getting used to in your mind's eye leading, and it's someone that I trust. And so I think that gift of trust and communication preparing the community was huge. For me, being younger, to be able to have the community trust me enough to learn and not have this enormous expectation on day one of being who Bruce was because the community trusted me over a period of time.
Two thoughts. One is just an observation. The other would be a gift. The first observation is the tumult that happens during a transition is an absolutely necessary tumult. You can't... people getting alarmed and scared, you know, as Elijah goes up in the sky and you're waiting for Elijah to come along. That just happens. That just, the freak out is going to happen, and you shouldn't take that as a refutation of your own right to be in that office. I think that, I've seen this happen a number of times, just when you have a teacher who has become sort of the notorious lit teacher or the notorious chemistry teacher, and then for whatever reason, they have to retire, they step on, and you've got to fill that spot. You see just within the students this sort of despair of, oh, but who could ever? And that despair is gone in a month when you put the new person in and then everybody gets adjusted and everything. And so the first thing I would say would be don't let yourself get too rattled by everybody expressing their concern, and don't take it personally. It just has to happen, and you need to not worry about it because – you know, God willing, in 20 years, when you step out and somebody fills your seat, they're going to have all the same
screaming and whatnot. So don't be worried about that. Don't take it personally. Just be confident, understand it, be patient. The second thing, I think the gift that I have, and this is peculiar because it's very bureaucratic. Our NSA, the way our policy or my relationship to our board works is we're under the Carver governance policy, which if you don't know it, what it means is basically every single quarter I have to sit down with my board, and their sole relationship to me is through a list of very specifically worded policies that are framed either as ends or restrictions. And each quarter I have to sit down and I have to report to them in what way I have not violated their restrictions and in what way I have fulfilled their ends. It's a very, it can be a tedious bureaucratic process, but what I like about it is our board is really put into that policy. They put a lot of thought and time into trying to name exactly what their vision for this school is, and they've been working on this for years. And so what it provides for me is every 3 months I'm having to stop and evaluate what I'm doing and then justify it, not in my words, but in their words. I have to stop and think through, they've said this, what does that really mean? And then I'm able to, and that regularly is, it's reminding me of the vision that I've inherited. It's reminding me of the obligation I have to the school. It's reminding me to think a little bit outside myself, and I just find it really helpful. I think that all real good blessings from God are blessings that tend to move generational, that you can pass from one to the next. You know, it's Jesus remarks that the fifth commandment is the commandment with a promise, that when you honor your father and your mother, it goes well with you in the land. And when you can look at those that went before you and identify what they were doing and what drove them and what their principles were, and then you can really sit and analyze yourself and what you're doing in terms of that and see, have they really handed on to me what they were working on? Is there a successful handoff? I think that's a real blessing, and so I've found those board meetings to be really helpful.
That's great, Ben. So I want to make this very interactive and participatory. So my role will be to walk around with a microphone and hand it to you if you have a specific question for any of our panelists. Just a format question that I think will help rather than just all three of you answering the same question. Maybe you can offer different perspectives. If you want a particular individual to address it, let me know, let them know. So anybody want a question to start us out for our panelists on this idea of transitioning leadership? All right, track back over here.
Thank you. We are in a good spot. We're in Tallahassee, Florida, Christ Classical Academy. And the school started, of course, like everybody else probably, as a co-op. And so it's from, and this has to deal with a little bit about that transition between what you once were as a co-op versus becoming what you're going to be and what you are, a full K-12 institution, and it's no longer a co-op. And so I'm in that position now. I'm a new head of school, just took the job about a few months ago. And so I'm coming into this position in the middle of this transitionary period between no longer a co-op into a K-12 full functioning program, which is great. We're very successful. We're, you know, enrollment's great. So it's just that selling that vision, I guess is what I'm getting at, selling that transitionary vision of specifically to the parents who've been a part of the school for so long, and it's no longer what it once was. When it was a nice little cute school with 40 kids, now we have 215, 20 plus. And so just speak to that kind of, I mean, if you've had experience in that, just selling that vision to the parents who are involved.
Guys, whoever wants to go. Charlie.
What was that again? Was it selling the vision of where you're transitioning towards? Is that what the question was?
So it's not some, because we've been talking a lot about the institution generally staying the same and the leadership changing. This sounds more like well, it's also new leadership, but also the institution is changing and becoming something new. So it's, how do you cast vision in that instance?
So I'll start this and maybe hand it off to the domain experts here who maybe can help answer that from a school-specific standpoint. But I do, I mean, the job of the management leader, so the CEO or the president or the headmaster, I mean, your job is to be the chief executive vision caster. So there's no sense in which there's ever a time you're not selling that vision and promoting that vision. Upstream from that is the necessity to be really clear from your board and from other stakeholders what that vision is, what are the edges of that vision. And particularly, I have found at DG, we've had a couple eras of one particular area of pretty tough transition internally. And besides being sort of chief vision caster, I had to become the chief reality caster. Like, my job was to ensure everybody understood the realities of the moment, what those edges were for transition, why we were doing it, what was underneath that, what name the paradigm shift that needed to happen. Don't be afraid of naming the core values or the core missional stuff that's going to continue, but also why things may need to change or why we're moving from this model to that model. I think there's a huge win with your constituents, your parents, your students, when you can actually honestly and winsomely put in front of them, name the problem that's necessitating this transition, and then push it ahead with a real impassioned vision. And then just recognize every single person on your staff and every single one of your parents have a hole in the bottom of their vision bucket. Everybody's vision bucket is leaky. So you can't pour it in the top of that bucket enough because it's always dribbling out the bottom of that bucket over time. And so the how do you cast that vision, you know, maybe that's more of a tactical question that these guys can answer. The necessity of doing that ongoing and working with your board to creatively sort of define and winsomely define reality and then cast that vision for the preferred future, absolutely. That is your never-ending job. And the job of your board and maybe some of your other key faculty, those people that every organization has them, right? They're maybe off in a corner somewhere or they have a different title, but people look to them. They're your functional vision casters. You know, having those talking points in line. So you guys are, I talk about this at DG all the time. The leadership at DG always has to be speaking out of a shared lexicon so that at every moment the staff is hearing basically the same thing said in a very similar way, so there's no misunderstanding about what we're getting up in the morning to do every day. So anyway, I'm just underscoring the necessity of what's behind your question. Yes, the vision casting has to happen. How that should happen, maybe I'll pass to these guys.
That's actually not something I've had experience with. So one of the things that I did from the very beginning was try to find other people that had a very, very similar experience as locally as possible and ask them. And so I think most of my first year, two, or now 3 years of transition have been trying to find the person who knows how to walk through that. So I would suggest, first of all, find someone as close to you regionally as possible to sort out the differences between our different geographic regions in this country and find someone that can help. There's probably some people in here. Is there anyone in here who has walked through that same situation? Co-op to the day school?
Sorry.
Well, there will be one tomorrow, hopefully.
Yeah. You'll be doing the workshop next year for us. So. Was there another question over here? Or, Ben, did you want to add anything to that while I'm...
I'm going to add one more thing real quick. The other piece that I would just say when I started in that was really helpful, it sounds like this is your first year as headmaster, was sitting down and trying to get each family's story. Why are they there? What brought them there? What have they seen? What have they learned? To be able to know you're not just going to an abstract vision. You're taking a bunch of people to something. Who are they? What makes them tick? What makes them excited? So getting to know them personally, I think, would be really helpful.
I would just reiterate what Scott said, the importance of getting faculty and board all in line. I think my temptation when I'm making changes is I want to go fast. I want to make it happen. I want to move. And if I do it like that, I find that I'm the only one there. You got to take the time to bring the whole crew along. And if you don't, you'll get all the way there where you got everything on paper and nobody's with you. One of the things that we did at NSA, and I got this actually from Dr. Larry Stevenson, who's here, is just having at least once a quarter lunch where I sit down with faculty and staff together. I used to be just with faculty or just with staff, but making sure that we sit down once a term and talk through all of the administrative things that are happening. And then this last month, one of the things that happened at NSA, and this was just a weird quirk, I'm working on my office, I'm remodeling my office, and so I moved my office into our faculty lounge. So my office is there in the faculty lounge, and it's in the summer, so you'd think, you know, you got some privacy and everything's fine. And I'd be sitting there in meetings, and faculty would come in, you know, to grab coffee or whatever, which is fine. And they would always kind of come in at first, go like, oh, don't let me disturb you, I just need to get this. And I'd be in a conversation or a meeting, and they're kind of tiptoeing past, like, you know, I don't want to disturb this. And within a minute or two, they turn and they say, but you know what I think? And everybody's, like, coming in on these meetings. And at first I found it, like, really frustrating, like, I'm trying to get things done here. But then I suddenly realized that I want them to be with me, and I found it to actually be suddenly a really a blessing. We won't do it all year. Sooner or later, I'll go back to my office, but I've found that, like, if I'm prickly about the faculty being a part of a discussion or other staff being a part of what's going on, then that means I'm moving faster than this administration is ready, and you've got to have everybody with you, and if you don't, you need to slow down until they're with you.
Great. All right, I think there's another question over here. Okay. I'm just going to stay on this side for a minute.
So obviously you all are very committed to the long-term success of your institutions, and Scott, you spoke about this just a little bit, but you all also seem to have some good years ahead of you, your whippersnappers. So how do you identify now, or do you, who your successors are going to be? How do you start grooming them? It looks like all of you had somebody ahead being intentional about how they would pass the baton to you, but, you know, God forbid you're playing for the two on the right go down on the way back to Spokane or back to Minneapolis. What would happen if that were the case? So it's kind of a twofold question. One is, when and how do you start grooming your own successors, identifying them, having a role in that? And lest we think that that's unnecessary because there are so many years ahead of us, obviously none of us are, we're all expendable to some degree or other. So what do you think?
Who wants to take that one?
So my answer might be really short. So my COO, if the plane goes down, he takes over. DG doesn't skip a beat. There's probably some loss to be had there in qualitative ways and everything in my profile. But in terms of sort of next chain in command, we're pretty clear on that. And by the way, this came from a real, a very heavy providence that hit our organization about 3 years ago. So my director of administration was diagnosed with esophageal cancer in August, and he was gone by April. And we really didn't have a plan, and a lot of work died with him. And there was a lot of long days and sleepless nights of literally having to kind of go through his files and his computer and things like that to figure out what needed to be done next, because we didn't have a plan in place. And so we, you know, the Lord brought us a real heavy providence to sort of get on my radar the fact that if any of my senior leaders go down, I never want to go through that experience again. So I'm one of those guys. And so there's a, you know, I could step away, and I think DG would be just fine in the hands of my COO. The larger question of kind of like, you know, one's career or sense of calling, you know, I think to some extent the answer to your question really lies squarely in the generative behavior that our boards should be engaging with. Sadly, most nonprofit boards do not engage in generative thinking at all. They're sort of good at fiduciary. Maybe if you're lucky, you got a board that's good with strategy. But the generative side of things, the begetting of the organization for down the road, that's actually where they're potentially most gifted. It's where they spend the least amount of time. And I'd put my board in there as well. Good men. I mean, I love these guys. And yet they haven't really addressed that issue
maybe in the ways that they should, because we're so focused on Piper right now. And yet at the organizational level, I think there's probably something to be said that they should open a conversation about that regarding me and the senior leadership. The short answer is, I think your board is the place to go for getting that question marinating and incubating over time.
Part of my experience was just serving faithfully in the little areas that I was given as a teacher, as an athletic director, that Bruce saw something popped out, and that was what pushed me on to the next level. And I think it's a great question in that are we as leaders looking within our own organization for people who might be demonstrating some little inkling of ability that we could give another project to, expand responsibilities to, and develop that way. So I would look at who's demonstrating leadership capacity within the organization now.
My thought would be I wouldn't worry as much about the plan as I do worry about the people, because generally what happens is people will say, well, we need somebody who can be a successor to that person. And what they do then is they start looking for somebody who has all the same attributes and gifts of that person. And I think that artificially constricts your search, because next generation, the first thing they're going to do is rearrange the furniture. They're going to change it all around, and they don't necessarily have to have the same lineup of gifts. But I worry more about finding quality people and trust that when they land, they will figure out the plan.
That's good. All right, other questions? While you guys are thinking, a question that came up in my mind was just, I know the answer to the role of the board in sort of creating this consistency, and I know a lot of boards have veteran legacy members that are kind of there to kind of prevent missional drift. They can kind of say, hey, we are not going to change this word and that word in the mission statement, and 10 years later, you're a different institution. So I think it's not only on the onus is on the founder, or the successor to the founder, but the institution through the board. So how does the board help create that consistency so there's not mission drift when there's a change in leadership? I mean, I guess generally speaking, we kind of know that's the board's job, but what does that look like? Are there documents, or are there efforts being made?
Yeah, I mean, you can always, your bylaws should be written in such a way that if the plane goes down and your whole board's on it, somebody could pick up and go from there. I think I get what you're saying, Davies. You read enough of the literature on board and board management, and some of you, that is your area of specialty. I mean, does anybody have the answer to that question? It really just comes through lots of time, as I said earlier, in the saddle together as a board. And maybe I'll just sort of play my cards, and this is not out of a sense of frustration. It's just the reality of the situation. Boards, especially founder boards, or maybe in your context, it's the founding board. So maybe you're at a school that's, 12 years old, 15 years old, and it's the same board, by and large, that founded the school. So there's your founder. It's 5 or 10 people, and they've been there since the beginning, the early days, and tons of sacrifice and things like that. Is that group of people, are those the right people to be talking about the paradigm changes? And when I say generative thinking, Richard Chait, in his book, Governance as Leadership, it's a great one. Richard Chait, he was the head of the steering committee on the board of Wheaton College for many years, wrote a book with Board Source and John Wiley, I think, called Governance as Leadership. He really, I think, hits the nail on the head in saying that so many organizations are frustrated and leadership is frustrated because these issues, the place, the space for those conversations to be had, where ideas like can be posited safely and not bit down on, but just discussed and spin the diamond and look at it from this angle. And let's spin a little bit more and wonder if so-and-so changed roles or wonder if this didn't happen anymore. That it is at that level of the, but most boards don't do that. It's just these men and women are coming from walks of life where it's just they're either used to doing the leadership because they're leaders in their organization, so they come in and they immediately gravitate to the strategy side and then get real tactical, so the micromanaging board we've all heard of, or they just are serving because they want to be near the founder, or they just love the mission and this is like they're an Uber volunteer and they got tasked with heading up the audit and compliance committee. And so they, you know, they're faithful in the fiduciary side of things. Or maybe they dip a little deeper than they should on the strat side of things. But they have no conception that they should actually be ideating. They should be positing new paradigms. Like, they bring to the table collective wisdom and collective insight and collective experiences. And then, so maybe it's on the administrator or it's on the chairman of the board to get that group speaking as one mind and positing and turning over the ideas. Not necessarily with any direct outlet onto the organization yet. But talk about 5 years from now, and talk about 10 years from now, and talk about 20 years from now regularly with your board, and let that be, and do that enough over time, and recruit board members that can do that well, that know how to hold ideas loosely. And I think you know, our institutions will move ahead. And I say that as a guy who wishes his board would be more in the generative mode more of the time.
Yeah, that's good. Questions? We've got about 5 minutes, so any question, observation? You want to present to our panelists? Right. Okay. Sorry. Yeah, throw the mic up. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I will apologize in advance of this question, and I'm not sure how complicated it's going to be, but it may last for 3 days. And the problem is I don't have 3 days. My name is Neil Casper. I'm a newbie to the whole scene. I retired from teaching 2 years ago, and I experienced a miracle. Had some health issues, cancer. I'm completely cancer-free at this point. I replaced both my knees. I walk 40 miles a week with no pain for the first time in 15 years. 2 months ago, I got a phone call asking me to come be a principal at Bethany Lutheran School in Naperville, Illinois. A list of 16 people. They decided they didn't want a newbie, they wanted an oldie. I'm 71 years old. So I don't have a lot of time to get this together. And I said, my name, it's Neil Casper. Have new knees. If I got out on one knee, you'd be able to remember it with a mnemonic device. Okay, Neil. Anyone that has any information to share with a newbie, I am open at any time for the next 3 days. I'm welcome to any comments that you have to add. So it's really, my question is for a newbie getting this started. I've got a brand new faculty. I love them to death. They're awesome. I've gone through the whole thing of who are going to be, this is going to take me 2 or 3 years to get through this process. Who are going to be the best people to teach this? I think the 14 people that I met with last week are the ones. But I'm going to have to prepare them, take them to the appropriate training so that they have their confidence. I don't know, am I off base? Am I going the right way? I have two pastors on board with me. Who are also excited. One is going to a conference in Wyoming with me next month. So I've got people reading voraciously as I do. I just don't have a lot of time, that's all. So as quick as the ideas could come, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, really quick then.
Yeah.
praise God for miracles. And let's pray for another one for you. But if he's done that already, then I think you can trust him for this one. Second thing would be, I think almost everybody here, and perhaps everybody here, could say each one of us is charged with giving the education we never received. And that's why everybody is here to do it. None of us were raised with this education, but we want it for somebody else, so we're figuring out as we go. So I think there you should not be uneasy about the fact that you're probably trying to fake it till you make it. That's what we're doing. And then the last would be the observation that you're at the right place. That is what the conference is about. I know that Logos teacher training in the summer happens in Moscow, and that's where a bunch of people come in to figure out in a few short days how to do this. And I believe that there are a few other opportunities like that that will be represented in the booths out here.
Final 30-second comment there.
30-second comment. You know, I love to see the passion that you have for what you're doing, and I think there's a beautiful saying that culture eats strategy for breakfast. You got a culture of reading, learning, studying as a staff, And that culture is what you want your students to become, a group of people who study, learn together. And so let that passion and love flow into those kids. God will work beautiful things.
I'll quote Yogi Berra because that can never go wrong in a panel. You can observe a lot just by watching. And I would say look for, so this is from the cheap seats of a guy that doesn't, I'm not doing what you're doing, right? But look for the people who, the great rebuke of Israel was that they forgot, right? They forgot their God. They forgot what he did. They forgot his saving works. Deuteronomy says, they were charged to remember, to remember, to remember. Write it on your doorposts. As you get up, as you go lay down, as you walk in the way, remind your children, remember, remember, remember. And they forgot, they forgot, they forgot. So be on the lookout, I would say, for people to hire, for people to groom, for people to surround yourself with, people who remember the greatness and the worth of God, right? Is it Psalm 145 that speaks of, I will remember your great works, your awesome and mighty deeds, and declare them to the next generation. That's the kind of people you want in your schools. That's the kind of people I want at Desiring God. People that meditate daily on the glory and the splendor and the greatness of God, and then don't forget to share that with others. People that when you get near them, it spills over onto you and to others. Those people that you want your parents and your students, there's a twinkle in the eye of that faculty member. And it's that preferred vision that has captured the hearts of the team there. You want to find those people. And then just bury yourself with them. Surround yourself with them. Go in the trenches with them. That's what I recommend.
All right. Very well said. We'll end on that great note. Let's thank you again, guys, for being a part of this. Ben and Charlie, Scott, you got about 10 minutes and we'll be on to the next session. So thank you.